Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this lecture. This is an introductory lecture to the course I'm going to be giving on Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. It will begin next week. I want to tell you before I begin the lecture, I won't be at my best today, which isn't very much to begin with, because I'm still rather shell-shocked. What happened was 2 days ago on July 4th on the media site, a review came out by me of a book by Stefan Molyneux. I really wasn't very familiar with Mr. Molyneux, but someone had asked me to review the book. And I don't know if any of you saw the review. I was not terribly enthusiastic about it. And as it turns out, Molyneux has a tremendous following, and his followers were not very happy with my review, and they've been subjecting me to all sorts of criticism and attack. Now, one thing you must know about me, if you've seen my reviews, I can certainly dish it out, but I can't take it. So I've been rather out of sorts since then. We're not going to be talking about Stefan Molyneux today. What I want to say a little bit about the novel Atlas Shrugged. And this is Ayn Rand's major novel. She wrote, as you know, also short stories and plays, and another very important novel called The Fountainhead. But Atlas Shrugged is her major work. She worked on it from 1946 to 1957 when it was published. Now, if you see the book, there is one thing you're going to notice right away. It's an enormously long book. It's well over 1,000 pages in most editions. I think it depends on the printing you've got and how big the print is. It's most editions about 1,200 pages. So we want to ask the question, why is it such a long book? Why is it so long? Was it just that she liked to write a lot? But I don't think that's such a good answer, because if you look at some of her other work, it's substantially shorter than that. She could certainly write much shorter work. So why is she writing such an extremely long book? Now, what I want to suggest is, remember, have to remember her background. She was Russian by background. She was born Alyssa Rosenbaum. She grew up in Russia, and she witnessed the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. Her family didn't do too well in the revolution. She left Russia to come to the United States, where she remained for the rest of her life. But she was very familiar with Russian literature. You remember, in 19th century Russia, according to most literary critics, the novel, as a form of literature, attained its greatest perfection, particularly in the works of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. And in particular, there's one novel that considered the greatest of all novels by most critics, and that's the book by Tolstoy called War and Peace. And thing I think is interesting when I ask the question, why is Atlas Shrugged such a long book? Well, War and Peace is also an enormously long book. So what I want to suggest to you is that Ayn Rand was writing this book, Atlas Shrugged, in a way as a rival to Tolstoy's book. She wanted to put in her claim as the greatest novelist by writing the work of comparable stature to Tolstoy. So she said, well, I imagine her thinking to herself, well, Tolstoy has written this enormously long epic, so she's going to have to write one also. Remember, she was quite used to epics because when she worked, when she came to the U.S., she was working for, when she was a scriptwriter, she worked for Cecil B. DeMille, who was a great producer of epics, like the famous movie King of Kings, which was a story, a Bible story. DeMille liked to do things in a big way. So what I'm suggesting here is she wanted to have her novel and be regarded as one of the great works of world literature, so I think she was writing in opposition to Tolstoy. And one thing that, to me, goes some way to confirm this hypothesis of mine, that she wanted her book read as a really a rival or counter to Tolstoy's War and Peace, is that the key theme of War and Peace is that human beings don't determine history. Remember, War and Peace, for those of you who read it, even for those of you who haven't read it, the book deals with the events involved in Napoleon's invasion of Russia. And a main theme of the book is that what happens is inevitable. People really can't control what's going to happen. They're just caught up in historical trends, and that really things are fated to happen in a certain way. The individual has very little influence on history. So the theme, they have this, again, this enormously long novel by Tolstoy, suggests that individuals don't have very much influence on what happened. And some of you may know, there's a great British intellectual historian, Isaiah Berlin, who was also of Russian origin, who lived roughly contemporary with Rand, who wrote and taught at Oxford for many years. He wrote a famous essay called The Hedgehog and the Fox that deals with Tolstoy's conception of history. So remember, Tolstoy, in this enormously long novel, is saying individuals don't have much influence on history. So you can see Atlas Shrugged, Rand is taking the opposite view from Tolstoy. Tolstoy says, individuals don't influence history much. We just have large historical trends, and they operate really they just go their own way. Individuals can't really do anything about them. Now, what Shrugged says, what Rand says there, is that what individuals do, especially creators and producers, is all important. It's really, in her view, civilization depends on a few key inventors and producers who are really the driving force of the modern economy, and they really are the ones who get things going. So as we'll see, when we get to the basic plot of the novel, if those individuals decide they don't want to get involved anymore, things are going to collapse. So you can see this opposition between the two views that I'm suggesting, where Tolstoy is saying individuals don't matter, and Rand is saying no, they're all important, and both of them have written enormously long novels. So my thought is, I put out for your approval, not I exclude Stefan Molyneux as one of those who can say whether he approves or not, but what I'm suggesting is that Rand wanted to write a great novel in to rival Tolstoy, War and Peace, which was considered the greatest novel by most critics. And she did so from a philosophical point of view in direct opposition to his. Now, one thing I hope I haven't gotten you into this lecture on false pretenses, because although the course is mentions Atlas Shrugged, and of course I'll be talking about Atlas Shrugged throughout the course, what I'm attempting in the course isn't a detailed study of the narrative of the novel, so we'll be going through all the details of the plot, and then discuss the various characters in it, and analyze the novel from a literary critical point of view. That isn't what I want to do in the course, but certainly if you take the course, you should read as much of the novel as you can, because this is the basic text. Of course, I should try to read as much of the book as you can, but what I'm interested in the book in this course is not in the book so much for its literary quality, but Rand had a very distinctive philosophy called objectivism that she expounds in the book, and what she's doing in the book, which is quite unusual for novelists, is she's using the novel to explain her philosophical system. So here she's going beyond Tolstoy. Remember, I've been suggesting there's this rivalry between, the implicit rivalry between Tolstoy and Rand, of course not on Tolstoy's point, since he died in 1910 and wasn't around when Rand was writing, but I'm suggesting she's opposing him. She has a philosophy that's going the opposite from the one he had. But where she's different from him is, although there are philosophical doctrines in War and Peace, it isn't a philosophical work. He has long sections on deal with philosophical topics, but there isn't as much philosophy in his book as there is in hers. So what I'm interested in this course is to use the novel to illustrate her philosophy. And I should say also that the standpoint that I'm going to be talking about is not that of a a disciple or adherent of Rand's philosophy. I think she was certainly an important thinker. Of course, she was no Stefan Molyneux, but who is? But although she was an important thinker, I'm not a follower of her. I just think she had ideas that are interesting and worth studying. Now, someone asked, I just see in the chat room, someone asked an interesting question that they want to know, would the idea of writing Atlas Shrugged to compete with Tulsa contradict her philosophy of independence? That's a very good question. I don't think it would really, because she would be still developing her own ideas. It was just she wanted her book to rival Tolstoy, if my suggestion is correct, but that wouldn't suggest she's dependent on Tolstoy in some way. She would still be, it would just be something like supposing you said that I'd like to come up with my own philosophy and collaborate some great new system. You wouldn't, in doing that, show that you were dependent on other philosophers who come up with the system, but it is a very good question. So as I say, we're going to be going through some of the main parts of the book, but not from the standpoint primarily of a literary analysis. Now, in spite of what I just said, that we're not interested in primarily literary analysis, we do need to have a short account of the main action of the novel, just so we know what's, what's going on. Now, as I say, the book came out in 1957, and the novel is set in the future. People have been disputed when exactly the novel is supposed to be taking place, but it's apparently late in the 20th century. It might be later than that, but it's in the future from 1957. So, the situation is that the American government is dominated by politicians and corrupt businessmen who want to restrict production. And it sounds like she's right on the target today. But what I think, like, when she is thinking about these regulations and politicians, she had in mind especially the New Deal with Franklin Roosevelt and what was called the Fair Deal, which was the government of Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman. And under Truman, there were all sorts of scandals where it was alleged that there were, Truman had connections to various political machines. So there were scandals. So I think that was in her mind when she was writing, that they're businessmen who bribe the government to get special privileges. This is one thing in the novel. So these businessmen and politicians are, in order to get special privileges for themselves, they're restricting production. What is the most productive system is the unhampered free market. This is a view certainly Ludwig von Mises would agree with, and she, in fact, was, read Mises, and she thought he was correct on economics, although she didn't agree with him philosophically. So she said, her view is, if you have an unrestricted free market, then everything will be all right. The economy would be as productive as possible, because then all these creators and inventors will be able to have incentives to produce and create. But if you can, if you have politicians and others who are trying to restrict production, impose rules on the economy, as one will see in Atlas Shrugged, there's a rule that you can't make any changes. People just have to go producing the way they have been in the past, trying to freeze the economy, make it static. Then the economy isn't going to be doing very well. And one thing besides this motive of corruption that's involved in the attempts to restrict the economy is the idea that it's wrong for the people who are very good or at producing, the more able, to get ahead of those who are less able. There's some people who just aren't very good at producing things. So some people have the idea, well, they should get a lot of extra help, people who really aren't producing for themselves but who still need to have food and various other things. So we should take away from the producers and give to those who aren't so good. So say it's wrong, say, for people, very good businessmen, to drive somebody else out of business because that person isn't going to like it very much to be driven out of business. So we should divide the business up so nobody's feelings are hurt, so everybody gets something. So in the situation which she's depicting, the American economy is really completely dominated by these corrupt businessmen and politicians who are have these regulations that are crippling the economy. So the most creative producers not only don't like this very much, but they decide to rebel. They're just not going to take it anymore. So how do they, what does this form of this rebellion take? Well, they gradually withdraw from society. They just disappear and set up their own community. It's in a valley. They establish their own little community, and people don't know, the other people don't know where they are. They just said, oh, all these prominent business people and others just not around anymore. And the reason is that it isn't disclosed till later, much later in the book, is that they decided they don't want to get involved in the society where they're going to have to be subjected to all these regulations. What they particularly don't like is, under the existing government regulations, they can't use their creative powers for their own benefit. They're supposed to be working on behalf of others, on behalf of the poor, or on behalf of society, where you take society to be some kind of collective body that we're all subordinate to. And they don't agree with it. They think that individuals should try to be responsible, each individual is responsible to himself or herself, and that what your aim is in life is to develop your own potential as a rational being, not to serve other people. Now, the ironic part, or maybe it's not ironic, is that Rand thinks if you have a society where creative people are free to develop on their own, then everybody will benefit. So it's a paradox in that if you try to say, well, the aim of society is to help those who are not so well off, or to help the poor, then what you'll get is a system of restricted production that won't work. But if you have a society where you say each individual should try to develop his own creative powers, then that will work out to the advantage of everybody. So even the poor will be better off. So what's paradoxical is that the conscious attempt to be altruistic, to help others, to say, you can't be superior to others, you have to, if you're better at doing things than others, you have to devote your better efforts to helping those who aren't as good as you, that leads to a situation that's not as good for the poor as the more egoistic policy. So, as I say, these creative producers have decided to rebel, and the leader of the community that they set up their own community is John Galt, who's the hero of the book. A phrase that keeps coming up is, who is John Galt? Read this a number of times. But the real John Galt doesn't come in under his own name until part three, which is the last part of the book. He actually is there in a very brief appearance before, but just as an unnamed workman that someone else named Eddie Willers is talking to. Eddie Willers is a workman at a railroad, and he talks to this person that later turns out to be John Galt, but you don't actually get Galt's responses to those Willers, you just get what he's saying from Willers' reaction. So the hero of the book really doesn't come in till part three. Now, this theme of the creative producers who are deciding not to take it anymore. They don't want to live in this system where the government is controlling them, or saying they have to produce only for the benefit of the poor, for society as a whole. This is how this relates to the title, is that the title Atlas Shrugged is, remember, in the Greek legend, the globe rests on the shoulder of Atlas. So Atlas represents the great creators and producers. So in Rand's view, society really rests on the great creators and producers. So you see, it's the opposite from this view I mentioned that Tolstoy had, that really individuals don't matter. They're just inevitable trends in history. They're just like sweeping people on. So she said, no, it's the few great geniuses who are really the moving force in society. So if they decide to go on strike, it happens in the novel, just like, we don't want to take this anymore, we're going to form our own community. So that in effect, imagine Atlas is holding the globe up, and he shrugs his shoulders, and the globe's going to fall off. So, applying this metaphor to the novel, if the great creators and producers go on strike, the masses of the people, the parasites, the businessmen and the politicians who are just living off others, will be unable to function without the great creators and producers. So you see, Rand's view of history is not only one that stresses individuals, but she's very much an elitist. She thinks that it's the great individuals, the geniuses, that count. And although she certainly doesn't want to restrict the rights of the masses of people, she doesn't think that they're really that important in comparison with the great creators. For example, the character I mentioned just a short while ago, Eddie Willers, is a very good person in the novel. He's a worker, and he admires the heroes and heroines of the book, but he isn't really treated as a very significant person in his own right. So in her view, it's really not only individuals who matter, it's a few individuals really matter much more than others. And I'm not endorsing that view, but that just mentioning that is her view. Now, in addition to this conflict between the government and the creators, where I just said the creators are going on strike, they're going into this valley, they form their own community, that John Galt is the leader, there's also a romantic story going on. Rand, as I mentioned, was a Hollywood scriptwriter. As you know, in Hollywood movies, romantic stories are the order of the day. So she had a rather odd combination of talent. She was both a philosopher and also a Hollywood scriptwriter. So she's really combining the two. So you're getting not only a philosophical novel, but somewhat of a romance, also a Hollywood romance. But the Hollywood romance in the book doesn't have the typical pattern that they always say, something like boy meets girl, boy loses girl. boy and girl get together again. Here we have something else. What we have here is that there's a woman named Dagny Taggart. Van had somehow to pick unusual sounding names, at least the names you could remember. Is one of the two heads of the family railroad. And the other head is her brother, who's evil. So Dagny is one of these creators. She's one of these people who are the creators and producers, the ones that Rand thinks that society really rests on these creators and producers. So she falls in love with Hank Reardon, who's another one of the creators. Reardon has come up with a new kind of steel that's much lighter and better quality than previous steel, so it's very useful in building railroad bridges and other things. So she falls in love with Reardon. Now, Reardon is married to a woman named William Reardon, who's one of the bad people. In fact, she married him because she doesn't like creators and she wants to destroy them. So she falls in love with Reardon, and then they get involved romantically. I must say, in her novels and also in her personal life, Rand didn't show much respect for the institution of marriage. So she has an affair with Reardon. She's previously been involved with this other man, Francisco D'Anconia. We won't go into him here, but he's another one of the creators who's pretending not to be a creator, pretending to be his playbook. And she's now in love with Reardon. But it turns out he isn't her final destination, because although Reardon is one of the creators, he's not as great as John Galt, who's the supreme creator. So it's a bit like, you know, the line from Ralph Waldo Emerson's poem. You see, she ends by falling in love with Galt, and she breaks up with Reardon because Galt is even better. So it's in Emerson's poem, there's a line, when the gods arrive, the half-gods depart. So see, Reardon is good, but he's not on the level of Galt. And so Galt is even higher value than Reardon, so Dagny now falls in love with him. So that's the big romantic story that's going on, along with this plot of the creators are leading society. Now, as I mentioned, Rand has heroes in the book, such as Galt, Reardon, Dagny Taggart, and they're also villains. And she's very much someone who, a hero who doesn't have characters very much in shades of gray. All of her heroes are good with few, if any, flaws. They're not always absolutely perfect. For example, it takes Dagny quite a while, most of the novel, to realize that she needs to leave her work at the railroad and go on strike with the other creators. So it takes her a while to get to this insight. And another example is that Hank Reardon is first reluctant to get involved in an affair with Dagny, because he thinks that getting involved in a sexual relationship is somehow shameful. And in Rand's view, that isn't the case. She thinks that the mind and body are unified, so you should have relationships with the person you consider your highest value. I say she didn't have much respect for the institution of marriage. So the heroes aren't absolutely perfect, although I think Galt is supposed to be someone who doesn't have any flaws. But they're very, very good, and they're also all portrayed as very physically attractive. And by contrast, the villains, such as Jim Taggart, who's Dagny's brother, Lillian Reardon, who's married to Hank Reardon, are all bad. There are a few minor characters who were intermediate. There's one kind of peculiar character called the wet nurse who is sent to supervise what's going on in one of the plants and make sure that they all the government regulations are observed. He's supervising the Reardon Railroad, but he turns against the government and he realizes that the government regulations are very bad, so he turns against them. But for the most part, the heroes are all good and the villains are all bad. Now, some people, when they criticize the novel, they say, oh, well, she just presents characters that are cartoon characters, a really great novelist show characters in more as they are in real life, where people as we know them have mixtures of traits. We don't really find people, or if we do, there are not very many of them really all good or all bad. But so some people say, well, it can't be a good novel because she portrays the characters in the heroic and anti-heroic terms. But I think we could question that. I mean, first of all, she was very much influenced by the French romantics, such as Victor Hugo, where you do have these outsized heroes, people bigger than life. So why shouldn't she have a novel that kind if she wants to? And then even if you think that on the whole it's better to have a novel where characters have a more realistic blend of traits, it wouldn't follow that every novel should be that. So even if you think most novels shouldn't have the type of characterization that Rand does, that isn't a reason to think that hers shouldn't. Now, what I want to do in the rest of the time is to deal, and this will be an example of what I'll be doing throughout the course, is to where I'll be taking a certain theme that comes out in the novel, expressed part of the philosophy. And what I want to do first is mention this a little bit already, is that a fundamental theme in the book is ethical egoism. And this is the view that what you ought to do, what the principle of ethics is that each person should act to preserve his or her life as a rational being without interfering with the right of others to do the same. And one expression of this is those who live in this town in the valley that Galt sets up have to take an oath, and I've given this, I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man or ask another man to live for mine. So her version of egoism isn't one you can do whatever you want. You have to respect the rights of others. You know, in one of my favorite novelists, I'm afraid one that probably Rand wouldn't like, P.G. Woodhouse, the great British humorist, there's a character who says to Jeeves, the butler in a lot of the famous stories, so he says, whenever anything comes up, I always ask myself one question, what's in it for me? That isn't a Rand approach, because in Rand's view, you're trying to develop your own life, but you have to respect the rights of others to do the same, and you can't use others for your own purposes. Now, in the objectivist view, all ethical systems can be divided into two categories. Those that are based on individual self-interest, those like the Latour system, where each individual is trying to advance his or her own interest, and those that support sacrifice to a collective or to other people. So the basic contrast is egoism versus altruism. Where this is the one we have in the novel, where we have the egoists are these ones in Galt's village, the great creators who are trying to be on strike because they don't want to be sacrificing their own ability to do what the politicians say, and the corrupt businessmen. So the corrupt regime, the system in power, is based on ostensibly you have to produce for those who are weak. You can't just supplant others if you're better than they are. You have to help out those who are weaker than you are. But even though it's ostensibly based on altruism, there's also an element of corrupt self-interest where people, the leaders of the government, are seeking their own interest, but not in the objectivist way, because they don't respect the rights of others. They just try to take from others. It's a kind of, they're seeking their own interest, but in a parasitic way. They're saying, how can I take from these great creators and use what they're doing for my own ends? So they're really, it's not, but in practice, not fully altruistic. They're not saying they're willing to devote their own welfare to the welfare of the poor. But the theoretical contrast that Rand brings out is that these ethical systems can be divided into egoist ones, say each individual is most advanced, his or her own interest, and ones that say you should sacrifice your interest to a collective or other people. Now, one question I could raise here, they said I'm not an objective myself, is whether she's right about that. Is it the case that that's the way all ethical systems can be divided into this category of egoist versus altruist? I mean, why couldn't there be a system that didn't say that what you have? Purpose of ethics is to advance your own interest, but it didn't say the other one either. I mean, maybe you could say, well, you have some duties to yourself, some duties to other people, but neither is primary. But she didn't see matters that way. She just divided them into the one or the other. Now, I think, although as I say, I'm not an objective myself, I think her criticism of altruism, in the sense she understood it, is one of her great contributions. And one thing we have to realize, if we're looking at say the history of Europe or America in the 20th century, is that collectivist morality has had disastrous consequences in the 20th century. I gave a course for the Leeds Academy in European history, 1789-1945, and we covered some of the things that happened during World War One, World War Two, we could see, if we look at that period, how doctrines that said you ought to sacrifice yourself for what was claimed to be the common good have had disastrous consequences. For example, the Nazis had the slogan, the common good before the individual good. So individual lives had to be sacrificed for the good of the mass Jew race. And we can see the disastrous consequences of what happened when that view was put into practice. I think Rand made an important contribution in saying, well, even if you don't agree with her, as I don't, that the individual developing his or her own well-being is the be-all and end-all of that, if you don't agree with her there, I think she made an important contribution that you're not required ethically to sacrifice yourself for some sort of collective body or some group of other people. Now, I want to now discuss another very important issue in ethical theory. And this is one that's related to the distinction we just made between self-interest and collectivism. Remember, we were talking about, is the goal of ethics, is it to advance your own interest, or is it to sacrifice yourself for some collective, or maybe, as I suggest, maybe there are other alternatives. Now, we want to deal now with a related distinction. Why should we be moral, if indeed we should be? Oh, somebody said, well, here are the moral requirements. Now, what if somebody said, well, here is the moral rules, here are the Ten Commandments, or here is your, make up your own, give me your own set of what you think are the moral rules. Somebody said, well, I just don't care about any of this. Why should I care about this? So the question could come up, why should you follow these rules? Here is a set of moral rules, let's say. And suppose somebody says, all right, those are the moral rules, but I don't care about that. Well, one answer is that it's in your interest to be moral. So it would just be something like, suppose somebody said, you shouldn't smoke cigarettes. You say, why not? You say, well, it's bad for your health. So this kind of answer would be, you should follow the moral rule because it's in your interest. This will be to your advantage if you follow moral rules. And as you can imagine, this is a way of answering the question is where Rand falls into this, in this answer, because she said, well, what is the purpose of morality is to promote your own life. So of course, she's going to fit into this category. But if the purpose of morality is to promote your own life, then you say, well, why should I care? It's because you want to promote your own life. It's in your own interest. So the moral theory then gives you an answer to why you should be moral, because moral theory is what morality is to advance your own interests. So that also gives you a reason to be moral. But as you know, if you study history of philosophy, that isn't the only view. That isn't the only view of the matter. Now, there's another competing view I want to mention, is that morality makes demands on you. So morality, in this view, isn't just a set of rules that say, well, you should follow these rules because you're going to be better off if you follow these rules. Just like I could say you're going to be better off if you don't smoke. It's good for you if you don't smoke. So on the view I've just been giving, we would be saying, well, it's good for you if you follow this morality. Now, the other view is that that's all wrong, that morality is just saying, here's what you have to do. You must or you have to do your duty, whether it's to your advantage to do so or not. Let's take an example that Rand wouldn't agree with. I mentioned before that in the novel, Hank Reardon has an affair with Dagny Taggart, even though he's married. So supposing, as proponents of this view probably would, supposing someone said, the proponent of that view held the view, you should not violate your marriage vows under any circumstances, just be calm to do so. So what the supporter of that view would say to Reardon would be, even if you're really not in love with your wife, you don't care for her anymore, you're very attracted to Dagny, you really ought not to get involved with her, because the moral rule is that you should keep your marriage vows. I'm not here intending to suggest or oppose a particular position about morality of marriage. I'm just using it as an example to show how a supporter of this view would give the view. Just the moral rules just make demands on us which we're supposed to observe, whether we feel like it or not, or whether it works out to our advantage or not. And there's an article I think you might find interesting. I think it's a very important article in History of Moral Philosophy. It was written by the English philosopher H.A. Pritchard, Harold Arthur Pritchard, called Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake? An unusual title. And what was the mistake was, he said, if you ask why should I be moral, why should we be moral, then you're reducing morality to something else. If you say, well, we should be moral because this is in our own interest, then you're really reducing morality to something else. You're explaining morality in terms of something else. And he said, morality is just autonomous, it's just there, and we ought to, we just have to follow the rule. So this is a competing view to the one Rand held, and one that Rand would very much reject. In Rand's view, we ought to follow the moral rules because it's in our interest to do so. In this other view, which is kind of very influential, you'll find this in Immanuel Kant's ethics. Kant was someone that Rand regarded as the main philosophical villain. So the view there is morality makes demands on us. It's not one that we don't follow because to our interest, it's that it just, we just have to do it. That's all there is to it. Now, I want to raise in, it'll be the last thing I'll be saying before we open things up to discussion, is suppose you accept Rand's view and you think that each person is trying to promote his or her own self-interest. So then you might think, well, I'm going to get a problem, because let's suppose that everybody has this view, so everybody's trying to advance his own interest. Won't you have conflict, because say, I'm trying to do what's best for me, you're trying to do what's best for you, so won't we have all sorts of clashes? And in Rand's view, this won't happen. Remember, I hinted at this answer already, because she said, you can't, when you're trying to pursue your own interests, you can't interfere with other people's pursuit of their own interests. So her basic view is that people's interests are in fundamental agreement or harmony. So you advance your own interests not by fighting with people, by cooperating with others. And the principal way you cooperate with others is by making exchanges with them in the free market. So this is one of the main themes of Atlas Shrugged, that if you allow the great creators and producers to work untrammeled by government regulations, they're going to have coming up with all these great inventions, and people will be involved in peaceful exchanges in the free market, and everything will work out for everybody's benefit. And this is also, and I don't think it's coincidence, the main theme of Ludwig von Mises' ethics, that social cooperation through the free market is the main point of how people advance themselves. William Jager calls the proximate goal of ethics for Mises social cooperation through the free market. So there's very much kind of a parallel here between Mises and Rand, and both are talking about the benefits of cooperation through the free market, where each person is trying to advance, do what's best for himself, but in doing that, they don't fight with each other, they cooperate with each other on the free market. Well, I think we'll end the lecture now. So what I want to do now, I'm going to the, since we have a lot of people, I'm going to the Q&A box, I'll open that, and if you have, you can have questions, discussions, objections. I hope we don't have people saying that want to tell me how great Stefan Molyneux is, although if we could have questions like that, I'll try to answer them. But I'm going to the Q&A. Now you can also, it's probably better to put your questions and comments in the Q&A, but I'll leave the chat open too, but I'll just go there now. I see I have a lot waiting for me. Here's one from Stephen Farrington. If you're interested in law, there is a heated debate in Mises University 2012 academic forum over your two-line proof in the philosophical origins of the Austrian system. If you don't, we'll just ask it at Mises U 2012. See, what is with my two-line proof? I'm not really remembering that. Oh, I think there was one, there's something they misread. They misread the way this thing was set up. They thought that one line in the syllogism was really part of the premise. I think that was based on a misunderstanding. Now here's one, David McNeese. How would you describe Rand's influence on society now, more than 50 years after Major work was first published? Assume for the person's question, there is such a thing as society. Well, I should say, remember, in the Rand view, is not that society doesn't exist, but it that people don't act to support for individuals. I think her novels have sold it extremely, extremely well, and I think she had a great deal of influence on the libertarian movement, although she herself didn't like libertarians much, but I think she had a lot of influence. I think Ron Paul read her and was influenced by her. So I think her ideas are very influential, and she has influence not only on people who read what she says and like it, but there are people who really hate her. And one thing we might discuss in some later lectures of the course is just what some of the critics have said. For example, Whitaker Chambers, who has been a member of the Communist Party, being communist and then became a political conservative, did a review of Atlas Shrugged for National Review magazine, where he said that he felt that throughout the novel there was a message saying to a gas chamber go. So he was indulging really somewhat of a kind of a totalitarian. I don't think that's justifiable, but that was his view. So some people really hate the book, and so it's had some impact on them, only if only in opposition. When I have somebody I see one from Martha Babson who likes my criticism of Molyneux, oh, I'll be sure to take my course guaranteed A for that. Okay, so here's one. Does Rand's view of morality take the right and wrong of personal decision, not subject to view of others? Oh, no, that would not be her view at all. I think she would consider that a kind of subjectivist or nihilist view. When she says that each individual is supposed to develop his or her himself as a rational being, she has definite views on what you ought to do. It isn't up to you. It doesn't mean you decide to do whatever you want, but I mean, you're supposed to engage in productive activity. You're supposed to be rational. You're supposed to have your emotions integrated with the reason. She has all sorts of requirements for how you're supposed to live your life, and she wouldn't think, well, it's really up to you whether you do that or not. She thinks if you don't, you do have a fundamental choice in her view, whether you want to live or die, but once you decide to live, there are very definite requirements. And she also holds a view, kind of unusual, if you don't say, well, suppose I say, I don't want to live, then she thinks you couldn't make any other choice. Now, here's one from Ingvild Bo. Within the subjectivistic tradition, is moral also subjective, or does objective moral exist within the Austrian system? Well, I think perhaps I'm not absolutely clear what you're asking, but I think what you may have in mind is in Austrian economics, the view is that preferences are subjective, but that in economics we have that view just because we're trying to explain human action. So what you're doing there, if you want to explain human action, you have to take the preferences that people actually have. So I want to explain why one person is choosing apples over oranges. Well, it would be because he prefers apples to oranges, so he'd be interested in that person. Subjective preference, but that leaves open for ethics the question, are there such things as right or wrong choices? So that's left open by economics, and being, if you accept subjectivism in economics, it doesn't require that you be a subjectivist about ethics. Wait, let me see anything else here. Okay, here's one. Wesley says, what will Quinn consider not discussing physical philosophy? The quizzes that I have are generally your multiple choice ones where I'll just give you, they don't tend to be very hard ones, but the questions will be discussing different episodes in the book. And also certain philosophical themes. So questions will be on those. I mean, they won't be very difficult. Ingvild has another one. Rand claimed Kant was the biggest evil that happened to the Western world. I find a lot of Kantian philosophy about me. Can you elaborate on it? Well, that's a very good observation making, Ingvild, that one of the things Rand criticized Mises for was that she thought he was too Kantian in philosophy. Now, Mises was a Kantian in his theory and knowledge, but not in his ethics. In fact, his ethics is very strongly critical of Kant. But what Rand didn't like about Kant was really two basic things. She said, well, I don't say that her interpretation of Kant is right. I think, in fact, it probably isn't. Her view, Kant said that we don't really know the actual world. All we know is what's in our own mind. So in her view, Kant was a subjectivist. We don't know the world as it is. We just know the world according to certain mental categories. And she also said Kant was a collectivist in ethics. She said, we're not concerned in ethics with individual happiness, but we have to do what the catechism, the imperative, tells us to do. She took this in a way sort of not related to her own interest in happiness. So that's why she thought he was evil. Now, the way Mises took it was, well, he certainly wasn't someone who thought we make up the world, but he thought there are certain categories, universal categories of thought that we have. To some extent, that was a Kantian view, but in ethics, his ethics was based on the utilitarian or demonist tradition based on individual happiness, or what a Kantian ethic. Now, here's why. How does egoism differ with libertarianism? Well, libertarianism is a political philosophy. Libertarians are people who accept something you should never initiate force against, that is, believe in individual property in the free market. That's a position in what kind of political society should you establish. Now, egoism is a philosophy that what is the basis of ethics, specifically the individual self-interest. So an egoist wouldn't have to be a libertarian. Egoists could have some other philosophy, a view as to what the best political system is. And the libertarian wouldn't have to be an egoist, you could say. Well, I think libertarianism is the best political system, but I don't accept ethical egoism. Next question from Craig is, Rand was no fan of Sinclair Lewis, but she recognized his greatness, so why assume she wouldn't have appreciated Woodhouse? I do. Well, Craig, I'm glad you like Woodhouse. Now, maybe I was too hasty in suggesting that she wouldn't like Woodhouse, but I think the reason I thought that is she takes writing extremely seriously. Although Sinclair Lewis had very different values from the ones she had, when he wrote very serious novels. And I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think Rand would tend to view Woodhouse as too lighthearted, if not really taking things seriously. It's just, humorist who wasn't really worthy of major thought. I think she would be very wrong to take him that way. I must tell you, I rather like him better than Rand as a writer, but that would get me in trouble in certain circles. My guess is she wouldn't like him, but I don't really have all that much to base that on. Now, Matthias asked, could you explain better the meaning of who is John Galt? Well, that's the phrase that comes throughout the novel. And at first, it's kind of an expression of people have it kind of a genuine, expressing kind of futility of life. And say, well, something like, I can't really do anything about things. I'll just say, well, who is John Galt? That's come to be a way somehow of saying that you're frustrated with life. And then as Galt actually comes in as a character, then it takes on the meaning of actually finding out, who is this person, John Galt, they're talking about. Now, Maury asked, what about charity? Well, in the Randian, you would think, if I'm saying, charity is not excluded. And she thinks that people are sympathetic to other people. So supposing you see somebody who's starving, you probably feel sympathetic to the person. You probably want to help them. However, you're not, in her view, under a strict obligation to help other people. She thinks that's really not a big, she doesn't make such a big deal about that. She thinks, as a matter of fact, in a free market system, the poor, the people who need charity would do better than they would under a socialist or interventionist system. But she doesn't regard charity as moral obligation. And again, remember, I'm not an advocate of her views. I'm just, what I'm trying to do in this course is more explain her views. We will get into some criticisms of them, possibly, but I'm primarily in the course just interested in explaining what she said. Now, here's one that Mr. Puskerich mentioned: Rand's contribution to ethics, what you consider her epistemology. Well, that's one, we'll be getting into that in one of the later lectures of the course. So her epistemology, she had a theory of concept formation. It's based on abstraction from, we start off with sense perception. She has very definite views on how we get concepts from the external world. So that's one I'll be discussing in a later lecture. So I encourage you to take the course. I'll say, sign up for the course and you'll find out. Now, Julia says her modeling piece was great, and Mary, what does she tell you? Well, that's very kind of you to say that. You'll get an automatic aid also if you take the course. Now, Scott says, what was Rand's view about non-coerced charity? Well, again, she thought that was perfectly all right. It would be up to you, and she thought people do tend to be sympathetic to others, but it isn't for her a matter of moral obligation. It isn't considered a primary virtue to help the poor. And she would make, also, in, say, let me give you an example. Suppose, let's imagine you're walking in the street and a beggar approaches you for money. If you felt very sympathetic to the person, you could certainly give him money. But if you, suppose you thought, well, this person's just drunk and really responsible for what his condition is, then I think she thought you shouldn't really sanction him, what he's doing, by supporting him. In her view, this is one thing I didn't get into much, the reason we picked sanction as the password for this lecture, what she calls the sanction of a victim, is very a key concept for her. So she thinks that if we have a system, say, not based on individuals, it depends on the victims of that system accepting it and giving it their sanction. So she says you shouldn't give your sanction or approval to expressions of bad value. So she would make a sharp distinction between helping someone who's poor, say simply because he's suffering from some kind of illness, you can't really help that, and somebody who's living a dissolute life, who really is where he is because his bad habits have gotten there. I don't think she'd be too sympathetic to helping such people. But it would, in case, be up to you. Here's one. What Julia Patterson said, what would Rand say about this example? A homeless person happens to win the lottery, he's walking around with $1 million. Would it not be in his best interest to mug the homeless person if she could get away with it? Oh, no, no. You see, if the person had ran believed very much in property rights, so it isn't that you can take away somebody's money if you think, and even if it's the case that you could make better use of it, if someone has acquired property justly according to the legal rules in place, the person is entitled to his or her money, and if you take it, you'd be stealing from it. So you couldn't say, well, maybe this homeless person is just going to squander the money. That would be bad for him if he did that, but you wouldn't be at liberty to violate the person's rights. And Dan says, then continuing self-interest or in fundamental harming, do you think this contention is evident in support of anarchy? And if so, could you argue that you engage in contradictions supposing only the first monopolist, i.e. government? Now that's an interesting question. Well, she thought that the purpose of government is very limited. It's one of protection and justice. But I don't think, it's a very good question, I don't think she would have said that her views on government contradict that of fundamental harmony of interest, because the reason for government is, remember, she's not assuming that absolutely everybody in society will always act ethically in his or her interest. The reason we need some enforcement agencies, whether we're Foster Rand or say whether we're Rothbardians or other supporters of individuals, and if we need protection agencies, is that there are some people who don't follow the rules. Some people try to aggress against others or actually do aggress others. And then besides that, there are disputes about rights and tyranny even among those who do accept the basic requirements of a libertarian society. So I don't think she would have regarded government as contradicting her view of fundamental harmony. And I think she would, well, she's wrong in finding monopoly, but I don't think she was wrong to say that her view was inconsistent with that of fundamental harmony of interest. Now, Steve says, what do you think Rand's view is that people who are not great, i.e. limited ability, but who are honest and do their very best to achieve while rigorously respecting rights of others? Well, I think this would be, say, example, I have to remember Eddie Willers, whom I mentioned in the lecture. I think she would certainly think that people like that are value, and you're certainly not justified in interfering with their rights, they're good people. She's certainly not hostile to them, but she doesn't think they're significant as the great geniuses and creators. She's definitely an elitist. She doesn't, isn't someone say, well, people are really of fundamentally equal value. That is not what the view should accept. Matthew said, could you highlight the difference between Rand and Rothbard? Well, of course, now the difference that for the most immediately apparent one is that Rand believed in a limited government, Rothbard was an anarchist. And in ethics, although Rothbard was in this Aristotelian tradition, where Thomas tradition, what determines the requirements of natural law, or what is good for individuals, what's objectively good for individuals, I don't think he could be described as an ethical egoist in the way that Rand was. And I don't think he's particularly committed to her views on epistemology, although I don't know that he rejects them either. He didn't write about that all that much. Like, she had a more comprehensive philosophical system. He was interested more in particular issues. I don't think he could be called an ethical egoist. And Julie said, how could this situation arise with people interested in harmony, as it seems clearly better to expend minimal effort to steal in a homeless person? You see, suppose you stole from the homeless person, I mean, you just snatch the money away from him. You say, well, that would certainly be in your interest, but it wouldn't be in his. So wouldn't that show that people's interests aren't really in harmony? That I don't understand your question. Well, I don't think that's what she means by harmony of interest. She doesn't mean there are no conflicts between people. Let's take this example. Suppose you're applying for a job. There's a job you really want. But somebody else applies for the job also, and the employer foolishly, from your point of view, gives the job to the other person. That's certainly not one of harmony of interest between the two. But I think what Rand meant, what Mises meant, is not that there aren't conflicts of interest, but that fundamentally each person's existence depends on cooperating with other people. We all need to have other, rely on other people in order to survive. That people, we don't survive by, or prosper by inflicting violence on other people. We all benefit from mutual exchanges of people. But you raise it in your question a very important point, that this fundamental harmony of interest doesn't mean that there, doesn't imply there are no conflicts among people. It's just that these conflicts occur within a basic underlying framework of people benefiting through mutual exchange. Maury says, Garvey says, could we say that my interest to profit from my action is your interest to profit from your action? We can both profit from activity only when we are freely interacting with each other. Well, I think it would be the case that we would benefit from freely interacting with each other, but it could be, say imagine a fight between two people, like somebody just overpowers the other person, takes what he's got, like say the example Julia gave, where someone just knocks over the homeless person, steals his windfall, profits from the lottery. I don't think you would say that the person who did that wouldn't be profiting from what he did. It would just be, so I don't think I think you're going a little too far there when you say you could only profit from your activity when you're freely interacting with each other. It would just be more that, in general, the way in which we profit from our activities by free interaction with other people. So you're basically right, but I think not absolutely so. Now Martin Jacobs said it's a principal irony of the novel. The producers strive at model based on constant labor union earning mechanism of looters. In fact, your literary device, do you think it works philosophically? Why? Well, here I think we have to make a distinction. See, when we say that a strike, labor unions, or activities of looters, what the idea is there is that the workers just stop working and they interfere with other people who the employer is trying to hire. But in a free society, people are free to stop working if they want. So that isn't an activity of looters. The complaint against labor unions is that they try to stop other people from working. So in the example of the Galt and his associates, they don't interfere with those who want to keep going. They just say, you don't want to be involved in the system anymore. So I think that, sort of in that sense, that I don't think that presents any philosophical problems from her point of view of her theories. Mike said, instead of who is JG, John McCoury, identified. What is JG? That one I'm not sure that I understand that question. I'm going to have to pass it. I don't get that. Sorry about that. Maybe you could write a bit more. And I'm just forgetting something in the novel. Now, Steve says, one of Rand's faults seems to have been an intolerance when honest expression of views differing from her own. Rather than engaging in discussion debate, she seemed to feel that such holding of different views of evidence of immorality. Agreed. Well, I think she was, according to many people know her, I never met her, but she was supposed to be quite, she could be quite intolerant. I think she thought someone was learning the principles of objectivism, then she would take a lot of time getting them to understand the system. I think once somebody had accepted her views, accepted the basic principle, then she did tend to take disagreement with them as a sign of intellectual dishonesty or other moral failings. I think that's right, at least according to accounts once read about her, that she wasn't personally so open, she wasn't such an easy person for long enough. This is, I think, where her Chambers goes wrong. Because she had that personality trait, doesn't follow it. She wanted to interfere with the rights of people who had different views. It's just she herself wasn't someone who liked much dissent from the views, at least among those that she associated with. Will you grow your mustache back out? Well, that would depend on what's in my self-interest as long as I'm in Rand. And I think that you have these tend to, that's an interesting question. Maybe I should just get rid of it. Wes says, what do you think is primarily the root of those who seem to hate Rand philosophy? Well, I think there's all sorts of opposition to Rand's thesis. One, you get some who just don't like the vigorous championing of capitalism. So some people don't like her that. And some people think, well, she's not, just not very good as a philosopher. They don't care for her her philosophy. She was very strongly anti-religious. There's some people who don't like that. There's some people, I say, particularly aspect of philosophy, a lot of people don't like it. People think we do have a duty to help the poor. Even those who support capitalism say, well, capitalism is the best way to support the poor, but we shouldn't be egoistic. And so they think that's wrong that she holds that view. I see Wesley Groom has some more comments about Chambers. I think it's interesting you're commenting on beards and mustaches, and your name is Groom. I guess you're interested in grooming issues. West of correction, what do you think is primarily the root of the hatred some seem to have for that philosophy? Well, I think I understood your question the way you're giving it now. So. Matthew said, thank you for lecturing. Your answers for the most interesting performance. Another guaranteed A if you take my course. What about the philosophy makes Jared Hausman said, what about the philosophy makes such random, such ardent advocates of war? Well, what they think is something like this. Remember, they're basing their system on systems based on self-interest. So they say they think war is justified only as defensive measure, but if somebody is attacking you or threatens you, then you can do really whatever you want to resist them, and they take a very wide view of what threats consist of. It isn't just somebody, say, aiming a missile at you, but they think radical Islam poses a threat to us, then we can just go out and do things to nations that harbor such people in them. No. Arnda, can you expand on Ayn Rand's view on intellectual property? Well, she was in favor, I'm not going to be a very broad topic. So it, basically, she allowed patents and copyright. She thought that was really the most basic form of property because, remember, for her, the creators are all important. So the creator of ideas is really, that's really the ethnic key, the paradigm of property is creative ideas. Mike said, oh, I see, what was that? Now, what is John Galton mean? What was I primary objective? Well, to portray someone kind of the ideal person, the ideal creator, kind of almost a demigod, someone who, to her, embodied the values to the highest possible extent. Now, Wesley, I think we'll make this maybe the last question. Doesn't Rand do an excellent job reaching the human psyche? How do you understand? Basic world. Look, I think she does, I don't know that, I think she does have very good insights at least of certain aspects of human character. I think there are other things perhaps not as much, but I think she does have a great deal. Well, all right, I guess we're out of time now, so thanks everybody. Thanks for coming to my lecture. I see just one question. There's a reason. What will you say to a person who's introduced to Austrian economics for Rothbard and Mises by the workbooks that ran a difficult time meshing the ideas? Well, I think you have to see if you could really fit them in certain ways. Like say, with the how you develop your economic system really leaves open what kind of philosophy you would develop. I mean, there are tensions between, I think Rand had some criticism of Mises even on economics, but I think basically you could fit them in. Well, all right, well, Wesley, we're glad to have you. Okay, thanks everybody. I hope you'll be able to come here for the course, which I think, Dan, does that start? That starts Tuesday, is that right? Okay, thanks everybody. Bye.